then around 11,000 BC, then 15,000 BC, and finally at depths of 27.5 meters, 90 feet, and more, an astonishing sequence of dates of 20,000 BC to 22,000 BC and earlier. This was not at all what my colleagues in the world of archaeology expected or wanted to hear, says Natawijaja, a world-renowned expert in the geology of megathrust earthquakes, who earned his PhD at Caltech in the United States and who, it becomes apparent, regards archaeology as a thoroughly unscientific discipline. A truly cataclysmic period. The problem is that those dates, going back before 9600 BC, take us deep into the last ice age, when Indonesia was not a series of islands as it is today, but was part of a vast antediluvian Southeast Asian continent dubbed Sundaland by geologists. Sea level was 122 meters, 400 feet lower then. Huge ice caps 3.2 kilometers, 2 miles deep, covered most of Europe and North America until the ice caps began to melt. Then all the water stored in them returned to the oceans, and sea level rose, submerging many parts of the world where humans had previously lived. Thus Britain was joined to Europe during the Ice Age. There was no English Channel or North Sea. Likewise, there was no Red Sea, no Persian Gulf. Sri Lanka was joined to southern India. Siberia was joined to Alaska. Australia was joined to New Guinea, and so on and so forth. It was during this epoch of sea level rise, sometimes slow and continuous, sometimes rapid and cataclysmic, that the Ice Age continent of Sundaland was submerged, with only the Malaysian Peninsula and the Indonesian islands as we know them today, high enough to remain above water. As we saw in the last chapter, the established archaeological view of the state of human civilization until the end of the last Ice Age is that our ancestors were primitive hunter-gatherers, ignorant of agriculture, and incapable of any architectural feats bigger than wigwams and bivouacs. This is why Göbekli Tepe in southeastern Turkey is so significant, because it breaks that paradigm wide open and cries out for serious consideration of a possibility, previously relegated to the lunatic fringe, that civilization might be much older and more mysterious than we thought. With the date of its foundation presently set at 9600 BC, exactly 9600 BC, as Klaus Schmidt was at pains to point out to me, Göbekli Tepe also requires us to reopen the cold case of Atlantis, which archaeologists have long ridiculed, pouring scorn and derision on anyone daring to utter the much reviled A word. As noted at the end of the last chapter, the Greek philosopher Plato, whose dialogues Timaeus and Critias contain the earliest surviving mention of the fabled sunken kingdom, sets the catastrophic destruction and submergence of Atlantis by floods and earthquakes at 9,000 years before the time of Solon, i.e., exactly 9,600 BC. The Greeks could not have known of Göbekli Tepe, let alone that it was mysteriously founded at the very moment Atlantis was said to have died. Moreover, they had no access to the Greenland ice cores dating the end of the Ice Age to 9620 BC, just 20 years before the foundation of Göbekli Tepe, nor to modern scientific knowledge about the rapidly rising sea levels, often accompanied by cataclysmic earthquakes as the weight of the melting ice caps was removed from the continental landmasses that occurred in this period. With all this in mind, therefore, the date Plato gives is, to say the least, an uncanny coincidence. In Dani Natawijaja's view, however, it is no coincidence at all. His research at Gunung Padang has convinced him that Plato was right about the existence of a high civilization in the depths of the last ice age, a civilization that was indeed brought to a cataclysmic end, involving floods and earthquakes, in an epoch of great global instability between 10,800 BC and 9,600 BC. This epoch, which geologists call the Younger Dryas, has long been recognized as mysterious and tumultuous. In 10,800 BC, when it began, the Earth had been emerging from the Ice Age for roughly 10,000 years. Global temperatures were rising steadily, and the ice caps were melting. Then there was a sudden, dramatic return to colder conditions, nearly as cold as at the peak of the Ice Age 21,000 years ago. This short, sharp deep freeze lasted for 1,200 years until 9,600 BC, when the warming trend resumed, global temperatures shot up again, and the remaining ice caps melted very suddenly, dumping all the water they contained into the oceans. It is difficult, Natawijaja says, for us to imagine what life on Earth must have been like during the Younger Dryas. It was a truly cataclysmic period of immense climate instability and terrible, indeed terrifying, global conditions. It's not surprising that many large animal species, such as the mammoths, went extinct during this precise time. And of course, it had huge effects on our ancestors, not just those primitive hunter-gatherers the archaeologists speak of, but also, I believe, a high civilization that was wiped from the historical record by the upheavals of the Younger Dryas. A controversial pyramid. What has brought Natawijaja to this radical view is the evidence he and his team have uncovered at Gunung Padang. When their drill cores began to yield very ancient carbon dates from organic materials embedded in clays, filling the gaps between worked stones, they expanded their investigation using geophysical equipment, ground-penetrating radar, seismic tomography, and electrical resistivity to get a picture of what lay under the ground. The results were stunning, showing layers of massive construction using the same megalithic elements of columnar basalt that are found on the surface, but with courses of huge basaltic rocks beneath them, extending down to 30 meters, 100 feet and more, beneath the surface. At those depths, the carbon dates indicate that the megaliths were put in place more than 12,000 years ago, and in some cases, as far back as 24,000 years ago. Columnar basalt does form naturally. The famous Giant's Causeway in Northern Ireland is an example. But at Gunung Padang, it has been used as a building material and is laid out in a form never found in nature. The geophysical evidence is unambiguous, Natawijaja says. Gunung Padang is not a natural hill, but a man-made pyramid, and the origins of construction here go back long before the end of the last ice age. Since the work is massive, even at the deepest levels, and bears witness to the kinds of sophisticated construction skills that were deployed to build the pyramids of Egypt or the largest megalithic sites of Europe, I can only conclude that we're looking at the work of a lost civilization, and a fairly advanced one. The archaeologists won't like that, I point out. They don't, Natawijaja agrees with a rueful smile. I've already got myself into a lot of hot water with this. My case is a solid one, based on good scientific evidence, but it's not an easy one. I'm up against deeply entrenched beliefs. The next step will be a full-scale archaeological excavation. We have to excavate in order to interrogate our remote sensing data and our carbon dating sequences, and either confirm or deny what we believe we found here, says Natawijaja. But unfortunately, there's a lot of obstacles in our way. When I ask what he means by obstacles, he replies that some senior Indonesian archaeologists are lobbying the government in Jakarta to prevent him from doing any further work at Gunung Padang on the grounds that they know the site is less than 3,000 years old and see no justification for disturbing it. I don't deny that the megaliths at the surface are less than 3,000 years old, Natawijaja hastens to add, but I suggest they were put here because Gunung Padang has been recognized as a sacred place since time immemorial. It's the deepest layers of the structure at between 12,000 and more than 20,000 years old that are the most important. They have potentially revolutionary implications for our understanding of history, and I think it's vital that we be allowed to investigate them properly. Atlantis. Happily, there was a decisive presidential intervention during 2014, and I can now report that Danny, I'll use his first name henceforth as we have become friends, was given carte blanche to excavate the site. He and his team began work in August 2014, completing a short season there between August and October, But as the experience at Göbekli Tepe shows, painstaking detailed archaeology is a slow process, and they do not expect to reach the deepest layers until 2017 or 2018. As the first season neared its end, however, Danny emailed me an update. The research progress has been great. We have excavated three more spots right on top of the megalithic site in the past couple of weeks, which give more evidence and detail about the buried structures. We have uncovered lots more stone artifacts from the excavations. The existence of the pyramid-like structure beneath the megalithic site is now loud and clear. Even for non-specialists, it's not too difficult to understand if they come and see for themselves. We have found some kind of open hall, buried by soil 5 to 7 meters thick. However, we've not yet got into the main chamber. We are now drilling to the suspected location of the chamber based on subsurface geophysics in the middle of the megalithic site. Buried structures. Chambers. Ah yes, I forgot to mention those. We'll go into the implications of all this in more detail in a later chapter, but in brief, the geophysical survey work that Danny and his team did between 2011 and 2013, deploying the latest technologies in electrical resistivity, seismic tomography, ground-penetrating radar, and core drilling, revealed not only deeply buried massive constructions and very ancient carbon dates at Gunung Padang, but also the presence of three further hidden and as yet unexcavated chambers, so rectilinear in form that they're most unlikely to be natural. The largest of these lies at a depth of between 21.3 and 27.4 meters, 70 to 90 feet, and measures approximately 5.5 meters, 18 feet high, 13.7 meters, 45 feet long, and 9.1 meters, 30 feet wide. Could it be the fabled Hall of Records of Atlantis? Danny has put his impeccable scientific credentials on the line with the controversial claim that it might be. Not only does he refuse to scoff at the idea of Atlantis, but also he's written a book arguing that Indonesia, or rather the huge areas of Sunda land that were drowned by rising sea levels at the end of the Ice Age, might actually be Atlantis. Danny and I made an extensive research trip around the whole of the Indonesian archipelago in June 2014, searching out megalithic sites off the beaten track that have never been properly studied by archaeologists. In Chapter 18, I'll describe our findings and how they relate to the Gunung Padang mystery. But meanwhile, I want to report here on the opinion of Dr. Robert Schock, Professor of Geology at Boston University, who was with me in December 2013, when I first met Danny at Gunung Padang. The view of Professor Robert Schock. Schock is a renowned figure, indeed notorious, for the case he's made based on strict geological evidence that the Great Sphinx of Giza bears the unmistakable erosion patterns of thousands of years of heavy rainfall. This means it has to be much older than 2500 BC, the orthodox date, when Egypt received no more rain than it does today, and must originally have been carved around the end of the Ice Age, when the Nile Valley was subjected to a long period of intense precipitation. A tall, rangy, scholarly man with a full beard and a mop of unruly hair, Schock was in his element at Gunung Padang, carefully interrogating the results of the geophysical scans with Danny, collecting samples and minutely examining the site. Afterwards, when he'd returned to the US and had time to analyze the data, he wrote, "The first important observation is that Gunung Padang goes back to before the end of the last ice age, circa 9700 BC. Based on the evidence, I believe that human use of the site began by circa 14700 BC. Possibly the earliest use of the site goes back to 22,000 BC, or even earlier. In my assessment, layer 3, some 4 to 10 meters, 13.1 to 32.8 feet or so below the surface, includes the period of the very end of the last ice age, circa 10,000 to 9,500 BC, when major climatic changes took place, with dramatic global warming, rising sea levels, torrential rains, increased earthquake and volcanic activity, widespread wildfires, and other catastrophes occurring across the surface of the Earth. There is evidence of collapsed structures in Layer 3, possibly the result of the tumultuous conditions at that time. Visiting Gunung Padang, pondering the dates and evidence of collapse and rebuilding that may have occurred here, I could not help but think about another major site, representing very ancient civilization, that spans the end of the last ice age, namely Göbekli Tepe in southeastern Turkey. I also think of Egypt and my own work on redating the Great Sphinx, the extreme weathering and erosion seen on the Proto-Sphinx. The head was recarved and the monument reused during dynastic times, caused by torrential rains, could have been a result of the extreme climatic changes at the end of the last ice age. Putting together the evidence of Gunung Padang, with that derived from Göbekli Tepe, the Sphinx of Egypt, and other sites and lines of data from around the world, I believe we're coming closer to understanding the cataclysmic times and events at the end of the last ice age. Genuine civilizations of a sophisticated nature existed prior to circa 9700 BC, which were devastated by the events that brought the last ice age to a close. Looking for the smoking gun. At 6,000 or more years older than the stone circles of Stonehenge, the megaliths of Göbekli Tepe, like the deeply buried megaliths of Gunung Padang, mean that the timeline of history taught in our schools and universities for the best part of the last 100 years can no longer stand. It is beginning to look as though civilization, as I argued in my controversial 1995 bestseller Fingerprints of the Gods, is indeed much older and much more mysterious than we thought. In essence, what I proposed in that book was that an advanced civilization had been wiped out and lost to history in a global cataclysm at the end of the last ice age. I suggested there were survivors who settled at various locations around the world and attempted to pass on their superior knowledge, including knowledge of agriculture and architecture, to hunter-gatherer peoples who had also survived the cataclysm. Indeed, even today, we have populations of hunter-gatherers in the Kalahari Desert, for instance, and in the Amazon jungle, who coexist with our advanced technological culture. So we shouldn't be surprised that equally disparate levels of civilization might have coexisted in the past. What I couldn't do when I wrote Fingerprints, because the data wasn't then available, was identify the exact nature of the cataclysm that had wiped out my hypothetical lost civilization. Instead, I speculated on a number of possible causes, notably the radical earth crust displacement theory of Professor Charles Hapgood, which, though endorsed by Albert Einstein, has since found little favor amongst geologists. This absence of a credible smoking gun was one of the many aspects of my argument that was heavily criticized by archaeologists. Since 2007, however, a cascade of scientific evidence has come to light that has identified the smoking gun for me. It's all the more intriguing because it's the work of a large group of impressively credentialed mainstream scientists, and because it does not rule out, indeed, it in some ways reinforces, the case for massive crustal instability that I made in Fingerprints of the Gods. We'll explore this new evidence and its stunning implications in the following chapters. Part 2. Comet. Chapter 3. A wall of green water destroying everything in its path. Could certain ancient myths and traditions, judged to be of no historic value by scholars, in fact encode accurate recollections of an epoch when humanity experienced a crisis so devastating, so cataclysmic, and so dislocating, that we lost our memory of our true past? Consider this account from the Ojibwa, a Native American people. The star, with the long, wide tail, is going to destroy the world someday when it comes low again. That's the comet called Long-Tailed Heavenly Climbing Star. It came down here once, thousands of years ago, just like the sun. It had radiation and burning heat in its tail. The comet burnt everything to the ground. There wasn't a thing left. Indian people were here before that happened, living on the earth. But things were wrong. A lot of people had abandoned the spiritual path. The Holy Spirit warned them a long time before the comet came. Medicine men told everyone to prepare. Things were wrong with nature on the Earth. Then that comet went through here. It had a long, wide tail, and it burnt up